Well, thanks very much. This is an interesting event to be part of, so I'm glad to be here and see some familiar faces and some new faces as well. So I'm going to talk about context and context being king, the cliche I've co-opted for this. So last week I was in New York and I was walking through Soho and right near the Course 77 World Headquarters, as it were, and I saw this promotion for today's event on posters all over downtown, and I thought it was really cool, so I took a picture. And so let's step out of frame for 1 second here. I took that picture and I posted it on my blog, and I offered the same kind of, you know, extraordinarily witty story I just told you guys about, you know, it's a promotion for this and blah, 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 and how excited I was. And someone commented on my blog, and they wrote, it's an ad for The Omen. And so there's a moment of context mismatch, and you know that's where we see a lot of humor, and that happens quite regularly on the internet when people's intentions and the context they're operating from doesn't always line up. And I should say this person who offered the comment to my blog is like an excellent contributor. You know, if you blog long enough and some people actually come and start interacting, so I don't want to sound like I'm criticizing this person. She was just operating from a different frame of reference and hasn't met me and figured out how dry I sometimes am and was trying to be very helpful. So I appreciated that. So, you know, I think it's an example to illustrate the power of context and the collisions that happen, like you were kind of talking about, when context is not really understood well. So you've been warned. So let me talk a little about context in terms of narrative. And, you know, if you remember from literature class or English class, we'd learn about setting. You know, is that part of the beginning of any story where they would describe what was going on. They would establish a context. The setting would say, oh, it's winter time and it's a blue house and a wisp of smoke is kind of curling out. And, you know, it would start to create a story around establishing this context, the setting. And, you know, if you remember from literature class as well, setting influences characters and setting influences behavior. Well, if you think about what we're doing when we design, we're trying to, create behaviors, and we're trying to have an impact on people. So that context, that setting seems to be very, very important. And as well, the context is a way, and if you think back to this mismatch of the Omen poster, it's a way that we make sense of the world around us. We need some context to do that. And it's a way we make sense of what our role is relative to the world around us as well. So these stories are, you know, it's one of the things that makes us human. And, you know, that's, I guess, a cliche, but there's a few in here that I'll try to use. Telling stories and the need for stories is something that makes us very, very human. Here's my next cliche. This is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I want to see a show of hands of people that know this. Okay, so we're about 70%. Those of you that don't know this, you'll see it tomorrow. I mean, it's ubiquitous and gets brought up in every presentation almost. I don't know if anybody else, any Maslows in the rest of the group? Okay, so I'm the only Maslow today. But so this is a kind of structure to look at different kinds of needs that people have, and you know, from the physical all the way up to the spiritual. They talk about self-actualization, and it's a useful structure. It's a useful model for you can throw almost anything on top of Maslow and look smart. So I'm going to throw stories on top of there. And if you think about what roles stories can play in our lives. You know, probably not so much with physical, but our emotional health. When we learned about catharsis when we studied Shakespeare, if anyone covered that in their high school class, you know, that's an emotional, healthful benefit that we get out of stories. And, you know, from there to mental health is not too big a leap. And even spiritual, you know, telling stories through interacting with widgets, with faith browsers, you know, there's an element of spirituality that takes place through a very simple story. So, you know, these stories are extraordinarily crucial to who we are as people, as humans. And I would go even further and say that, you know, biologically, I'm gonna coin a phrase here. There's a neural imperative to process stories. And so, let me show what I mean by that. Another show of hands here: Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. Who's read this book or has it and may someday want to read it? Okay, a little low. So let me first of all recommend this book very highly. It's a quick read. It's not a historical study of comics, but it's kind of a delves into and explains what makes comics, and he even struggles with the word, is this sequential art or these graphic novels, what are they? Takes kind of an art history perspective and kind of a psychology perspective and a visual perspective. What makes these things kind of work? And bonus, it is a graphic novel form, so you're not reading a lot of prose type stuff. It is very provocative. It's about creativity and a lot of other things as well. So relative to this neural imperative, he talks about what makes comics work. How can we experience these things and have them be successful as stories? And so here's a page from one of the Sin City comics. And what Scott McCloud says is that it's all about that. It's all about these spaces between the boxes. That's the moment at which our brain links two different things together. So we see a picture of Charlie Brown, and then we see a picture of Charlie Brown a few feet forward, and he's about to kick a football. Well, who's to say that's the same guy, that it's happening right after, that it's not just 2 days later? There's a lot of information that we process very, very quickly to make a coherent narrative out of it. And that's kind of our brain working to process these stories. So another example here from film. So this is a bit of an abstraction in that I'm taking a motion picture and representing it in a series of stills, but bear with me. I think the point bears out. So what we have here is a series of cuts. Pun alert, everyone, okay? That one, I'll take that out of the next rev. You gotta throw a few out and see which one stick. That one didn't. Stick? No. So what's to say to us when we watch this scene that's Janet Leigh's eye and then that's her mouth? Or when we see a person showering and then we see her shower again, why do we assume that that's the same shower? Maybe that's her, yesterday having a shower and here she is today. Or that the knife and the stomach are in the same physical space. That information is not explicitly presented. There's no master shot in this. It's all a series of close shots. And yet we know what's happening. And you don't sit there and reflect and say, oh, I bet that's the same shower. Or I bet that guy is in the shower with her and he's stabbing her. You don't go through that consciously, right? Your brain is just putting that together very, very quickly. So we are sort of operating in a way to establish and create stories for ourselves. And again, that's that neural imperative I'll point to. And then a couple of other things on stories here that are little divergences that I will recommend. This is 99 Ways to Tell a Story. I don't know if people have seen this. You can see a preview on exercisesinstyle.com. And what this is the same story. It's a one-page story. It's told 99 different ways through different. They're all graphic novel-esque. So in one case, this little interaction takes place. You're in the house when it's happening. Another place, you're in another room. Another place, you're in the fridge. Another place, you're across the street. And another one is using different styles. One of them straddles three different comic strips to tell the same story. So it's a very provocative kind of just creative quick exercise to look at ways that a single story can be presented in lots of different styles. So the story from the meta story is an interesting thing to explore. And that's based on this. Anyone know this one here? I just learned about this very recently, so. And not to sound like I know every book. Okay, so we've got a couple here. This actually is the English translation of a French book that is just prose and tells this story about a guy getting on a bus and someone stepping on someone else's feet and he gets off the bus and then sees the guy later and someone is talking about his coat button. That's the story. And they tell that story, 100 different ways or something like that with... and you sort of think like, how many different ways could it be told? Well, who's the person telling the story? Is it the narrator? Is it an observer? What's the mode of discourse that kind of makes it take place? So just some things to kind of delve into stories as a format, if you're kind of interested in that. So back to talking about design. There's kind of this duality here in that, as Alan and Diego have mentioned, understanding the context is a starting point to designing things, but also when we design things and put them out there, we create new context. So it is this kind of this cycling thing that's going back and forth. So let me talk about just some of the basic context aspects, and hopefully I'm not going over too much ground that you guys have covered here. So we can look at things like who. So there was a story a few years ago about a snow shovel that won some design award for design research. And what the story was, designers went out and looked at who was shoveling snow, and they found it was women, it wasn't men, and so they had to redesign the ergonomics of their shovel, and they won an award for that. All right, so that's sort of a basic That's where you have to start, I think. But that was an award-winning thing a few years ago. And we can look at when, and we can understand a lot of context through some of these cues of time. So when this artifact was first produced, one of the ways it was described was the horseless carriage. Right? It was described in reference to other artifacts, and it was described based on what it didn't possess. So when you look at how we even, what words do we have to talk about things that are in our culture now or in other time periods, reveals a certain amount about what the frame of reference is. And so when you create something new, often there's no way to talk about it except in reference to something that previously exists. So that kind of gives you some cues about what has been designed and how that's changed things and how you can start to design new things. So another example, obviously, is the cordless phone or the wireless phone, are sort of terms that get used at different points. You know, in other parts of the world, they call it the mobile, right, which talks about the role that is playing in the larger ecosystem of culture in a slightly different way. You can look at interaction styles. You know, we see interfaces or websites and things, and we talk about how they're dated, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're difficult to interact with, but that there's something aesthetic or fashion-wise. One of the things that people that are, you know, kind of make fun of Web 2.0 as a movement, if you will, they make fun of the visual elements that are used, the gradients, the fonts, the colors, and so on. And I don't know if people saw this graphic that went around the blogosphere about a month ago or so. And it's just a compilation of not even the interfaces, but just the logos of Web 2.0 companies kind of all put together. And you can see some, you know, color patterns. It's actually a much larger graphic than what I was able to fit on this page. You start to see some things happening, and you know, you can call this fashion, you can call it trends, but it also, if you're a designer making a logo, this is the ecosystem that you have to start to work within. So understanding that context, and this obviously is going to look crappy. If it doesn't look crappy now to you, it's going to look crappy in 6 months or a year or 2 years, and we'll just laugh at it for many reasons, the way we do about sort of 99 era stuff. Laugh or cry. So where is another, obviously another aspect of context. And so people, I'm sure, have heard about third places. You know, Starbucks was probably one of the biggest claimants to the third space. You have home and you have work and you have these third spaces, other environments where activities are taking place that we need to design experiences for. Even San Francisco, people that live here, and you know, we have this powerful kind of cafe culture where you can see people working full day shifts on their laptops in these kinds of environments. So a number of years ago, we had a Who are you people and what are you doing in my bedroom? So if something starts falling, you can just get out of the way. No, just tell me so I'll duck. Yeah. Right, physical health and then emotional, so. All right, that was very exciting. That was very exciting. And let's see what's happening with our screen. And, you know, I said I wasn't gonna fall off the stage this time, but this was, you know, you guys are witnesses, that was not my fault in any way, right? Wow. Yeah. You have been warned, right? Well, if anyone took a picture of that, like, I won't be in the picture, right? And so we were talking about third place. Oh, yes, I was sharing a witty anecdote with you when all of a sudden I got hit on the head. So we were looking at, this doesn't count towards my 20 minutes, does it, by the way? Okay. I think I should get quavery bonus time because it takes me longer to get the words out now. So we're working on this project on laptop usage in these other kinds of environments besides the ones they were nominally designed for, homes and workplaces. And we actually sat, as part of the research, we sat in a park on a hill with a guy who was sitting in a tree, low down in a tree, but in a tree nonetheless, and editing video. So it was an interesting kind of environment to get to be in to see how products were being used, and then obviously to consider what the implications for design were for that. Sociologist Irving Goffman is one that I always like to cite because he's the only one that I know. And makes me sound smart, unless, of course, you know about sociology, in which case I just look like everybody else that always cites Goffman. But Goffman's model, very briefly, I'll give my version of it, is that he posited people as actors. And as actors, we can spend time on stage or off stage, or front stage or backstage was his proper term. And sometimes stages are dangerous, but you know, when you leave your home, you're front stage. When you're home, you're backstage. And as actors, we use props to help construct our identity, our persona that we kind of put out into the world. And there's lots more to it than that, but just that in itself is kind of a powerful model for looking at the world. So you know, here we are in this picture in Tokyo, looking at young women in a trendy area, and where the kinds of products they're using and the way that they're using them. So obviously, you know, again, you have a fashion element. You have clothing, you have purses, you have shoes. You know, if you've been to Japan, you know, you have mobile devices that are being used, not only how they appear, but also in what social contexts are now being established in this front stage world, which exists so commonly, in especially in big cities, you know, like Tokyo, for example. So the home office is another sort of new emerging space where we have devices that were designed originally to be in workplaces. So we have computers, we have printers, we have fax machines, we have filing cabinets, and other kinds of storage, all sorts of things that are sort of making their way into the home. And sometimes they're just designed as sort of smaller versions, you know, the baby version to fit into a different environment. But obviously there's other constraints on usage that need to be thought about to sort of design for that environment. And then the corollary there is that things from the home are making their way into the workplace and have been for quite a while. So here's a picture I took off of Flickr. And if you know, Flickr has the notes function where you can sort of put some meta content. This person put up a picture of their desk, Yum Kid, and had a note about every single one of those photographs, which is kind of, you know, like acne with boxes on it, as they were kind of talking about what each of these pictures were and what they meant. And you know, you'll see the stuffed animals. So you look at this person's office and you see their desk, and you see photographs and toys and stuff. And somewhere in the background is like that Meridian phone or the computer monitor. It's very secondary. So again, the context of where is a dynamic that's evolving as well. So yes, we have to go and learn about people and learn about what they need in order to design things for them, right? That's just good design. But I'll say that's not innovation. And you know, without opening up a dangerous channel of like, well, what is innovation? I'll just say it's kind of like art or pornography, right? I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it. So how do we get to innovation? And there's lots of ways, and I don't claim this is the only way or this is the complete path, but this is one of the things I think is really important, and that is this cultural context that Jesse mentioned before. It's really important to discover what that cultural context is. We've talked about sort of the more you know, person, place, and thing contexts already, but there's this cultural piece. And another way to think about that is to identify what the cultural norms are. By the way, norms is another sociology word. I don't know who invented it, but I can drop that and sound smart. So really what that is just asking the question, what is normal? And that's a loaded phrase. You know, as a layperson, what is normal is a judgmental question, right? We think about someone being abnormal or not being normal. We're criticizing them, we're sanctioning them, and saying that they don't fit into what's acceptable and that they're weird and they're also bad. But it takes sort of a more of a dispassionate, you know, creation of things of you, as you want to understand people. Thinking about what's normal is asking the question about what are the rule, what are the often unspoken social rules which define how people choose things, how they use things, what behaviors they're willing to engage in, and so on. So one sort of classic example is the hands-free phone. Where you see someone, and the Bluetooth is Lieutenant Uhura enough that you see it, but in the days where people were just wearing the small thing with the cable, you'd see someone walking through the grocery store talking to themselves. And, you know, that has become more of a normal behavior, but we still kind of joke about it. If we see somebody in a car next to us or somebody walking around, at least with a cell phone gesture, that's become more normal because it's become so present. But a lot of these things you can look at, and we kind of tell jokes about them because they're in transition. Our culture is still wrestling with, you know, what is normal and what do we want to accept or what do we want to make jokes about as a way to kind of push contexts against each other. So let me give some examples of this here. This is a picture I took earlier this year in Bangalore in India, walking through a park on a Saturday morning, and there's two young men, they're walking kind of arms linked together. And what I like about this picture is, if we were to like not look at the screen, and I would say, I'm gonna show you a picture of two men walking with their arms linked down in a park. We would, many of us would start to assume, well, that's a story about two gay men who are together. And, I didn't speak to these people, and I can't say for certain, but I'd say, the cues that are in that photograph is that this is a friendship. This is not the cultural baggage that I just presented, and what I think we would all assume is presumably not present there. And, so you move from one culture to another, and something very, very fundamental radically shifts in meaning. And, so I like this picture to help remind me of things that I take for granted as I look at different cultures, whether they're global cultures or just other cultures of other users, that it's very easy to bring a lot of your own assumptions with you. And here's just this vivid challenge to that. This is an image from a play that just closed here in San Francisco called A Number. I see one person who maybe saw it at the ACT. It was a really excellent play. Unfortunately, just closed. But in this play, the actor on the right plays three, in subsequent scenes, plays three different sons of the actor on the left. And they had a Q&A session after the play, and they explained to us that this had originally been put on in the UK. And in that version, the actor who played the different sons used accent as a way to differentiate the different sons from one another, because it's just one actor doing quick costume change. Because in the UK, they have a much more powerful association with accent and with class. People that have seen Pygmalion and My Fair Lady and so on, you know, you're familiar with that phenomenon. And so here we had the same artifact, the same play, and you move it from one place to a next, and suddenly the parameters that they have to deliver that to you are radically different. He can convey some things by accent, but it wouldn't work the same way that the actor who did the role in the UK could. So again, you're moving from cultures, and there's these underlying cues of context that are, I think, interesting, and depending on what you're exploring, you can work on those to solve certain problems. This is an ad from a couple of years ago, and so here's three really fat, sloppy guys eating the world's largest hoagie, right? And the ad says, "Bring it on!" It's an ad for cooler toilets. It's the level 5 flush technology. To me, advertising's job is to get your attention, right? And to do that by pushing the edges a little bit. But this is an ad for poo, right? I mean, we have a poo taboo in our culture. We don't talk about it. It's weird for me to stand up here and talk about it. They're talking not about, they don't see the product, you don't see it being used. You're asked to draw some rather unpleasant suggestions from the men's girth and the amount of food that they're eating to suggest what performance this product is kind of capable of. We don't talk about a lot of products that way, right? This is an unusual way to deliver a message and represents, I think, over time, the way the context within our own culture is kind of changing, and that it's clearly acceptable, and that these guys were not fined or, no one torched their facility, and this didn't produce a scandal that anyone else has heard about. It's tolerable within some measure to do something like this. Okay, so I was showing this example about a month ago at a conference in Toronto, and afterwards we went and walked around in the city a little bit, and lo and behold, I see this. Dog poo from your lawn ends up in the lake. After I just waxed philosophical about the use of the word poo and got to stand on stage and say that and, be all shocking-like, here it is in an ad. In the 2 years since the Kohler ad came out, clearly we can now print the word poo in on public spaces as a way to kind of raise awareness about environmental health and our role in that. So again, you know, you can just watch the line move. In fact, moving very rapidly, and we walked about two blocks from this garbage bin, and in fact, someone had crossed off poo and written shit. Okay, so it's now meta content. It's not within the ad itself, but you know, the levels of discourse around, you know, caca is changing, and in a kind of interesting ways, I think, because it's interesting to me to talk about caca. So the last point I want to make is to look for overlaps, and by overlaps I mean you know, things that don't necessarily fit into one endpoint or another, or fit into both, or lurk in some space in between, whatever continua you want to kind of craft. It's where things are colliding and not necessarily making sense, but there's something there. There's opportunities to innovate, or there's a terrible failure awaiting you. You know, you have been warned if you fail to pay attention to these areas of overlap. So just a couple of quick examples. This is a squat toilet from Tokyo, and people who are involved in interaction design, they talk about error recovery as kind of being a, you know, a constraint on a design. And so I always use that as my reason for why I never tried one of these toilets, because the penalty for failure is pretty drastic. So I've never used one. But they're fun to take pictures of and look at with, you know, my Western perspective, where I look at this and I say, like, oh my God, that is just so primitive. You know, it's like a hole in the floor, and you know, how can the Japanese do this? But then, you know, here's the overlap. This is the same culture that produces like more cutting-edge toilet technology than we can imagine, right? There's always some story in the press about the Japanese are wacky with their toilets, blah, 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 blah. So here's one example. This is a box that I think typically in the women's public bathrooms sits above the tank. You press that button and it makes the sound of running water. So this is, you know, this is a, so what that led, in case anyone's wondering, that fills in for that thing that we sometimes do, and I don't know if anyone wants to admit it, but I'll admit it. Sometimes you flush, and then you have kind of an acoustic window in which to complete your task without being overheard. Well, that's very wasteful of water, so leave to the Japanese to solve a behavioral problem and an environmental problem with a little piece of electronics. And the flip here is that you're doing this to protect the other people from being embarrassed, other people around you from having to hear you. So there's a different social context around that as well. But so, you know, we've got this like hole in the floor, and then we've got electronic fake flushing sounds. So it's hard to reconcile. That doesn't really make sense to us. You know, are they early adopters of technology, or are they late adopters of technology? Well, that's not even the right question to ask, but so from our perspective, we see some kind of overlap between different things. And I'll just offer one last example. This is a picture from Bangkok. And so here's Ronald McDonald, right, the quintessential American icon, and he's doing this gesture, and the gesture is called Wai, W-A-I, and so it's hands folded at the chest, and kind of just a bend over, and so it's just a greeting. You come into a place or you leave a place, you get this kind of friendly gesture. So there's Ronald standing outside of McDonald's, and he's doing that gesture. And you know, we think of Ronald as being representing our culture very, very strongly, but he's being extraordinarily Thai in his behavior right now. And not to mention like what's on the menu, right? If you go to other countries and you just can marvel at what McDonald's sells, right? The big thing of corn. I mean, just stuff that doesn't make sense to us. That's not McDonald's. And so I think this is an interesting example where it doesn't make sense, right? We, you know, within the Thai culture, it's perfect to create this brand and have these products on the menu and have this symbol of who you are. But hey, this is the jet age for a long time, right? We can all get on airplanes and go to other countries and see, you know, our construct of Ronald like entirely broken. Like that makes no sense. Ronald's not Thai. He's American because he's a clown, right? We know what he is. And we can be exposed to things that don't kind of make sense. I'm not saying this is a problem or a failure and we have to solve this, but it's something to make note of in looking at cultures where things that doesn't quite make sense, and I don't really know why, and isn't that interesting, and there's something more here to kind of dig into. Thank you very much.